Welcome to another episode of Footlock, or For the Love of Cars. And thank you for joining us again. This has been, it's been sort of slightly sporadic over recent weeks, simply because we've all been away on holiday. And this week, as you can see, Drew is away on holiday. So I'm afraid you've got me. And in Drew's place, we've got Charlie.
Yeah.
So Charlie is going to be helping me sort of sift through the news and, more pertinently, some of the films that we've been doing and we've released this week, particularly the Chiron film, because you were on the Chiron film and you edited it.
Yes.
Very nicely and carefully. And
thank you very much.
Over plenty of time.
Yeah,
so
lots of time.
We'll go through that and some of the comments that were left below it as well. So try and answer some of your questions. So without further ado, old Drew always said, what did he say? He says we need to subscribe
and
notifications, bell icons. Instagram, Twitter, Facebook.
At Carfection Films on Instagram, yeah. At Carfection on Twitter.
Handles. Just look for Carfection and click like and everything. Just click all the buttons. Tremendous. Thank you. It does help us. Anyway, news. So I'm going to start with the new BMW Z4, which was unveiled, amongst other cars, which we'll come to, at Pebble Beach over on the west coast of America. And... well, first impressions, firstly, you go for always looks, and to me it looks a little bit like a Fiat 124 Spider, that front end. The rear looks quite like a sort of squashed version of the old Z4, looks pretty good, but the front's not entirely sure about that.
Yeah, I can see that.
So it is got a folding fabric roof, which I think is quite nice. We're not going for
saves
a folding...
30 kilos.
30 kilos,
of the old hardtop. Folding roof.
There we go.
Or maybe and, was it 60? It could be 60.
I think I had 50, so it saves some weight that is not insignificant over the, and of course it's saving weight high up as well, which is always important. So it's going to bring the center of gravity, the CFG, down, which is good. Yeah. They unveiled the Z4 M40i first edition. There will obviously be other models in the lineup over the coming sort of weeks and months as they unveil more technical details, which I think we're due to get at the end of September, possibly, I heard. This one had a 3-litre straight six, always good. Classic BMW, really, can't go wrong with that. 340 brake horsepower, not 62 in 4.6 seconds, which is rapid enough, isn't it?
Yeah.
Get the wind in your hair. And importantly for us, it's got an M-Sport differential, which is definitely a good thing. And there are rumours that some of them are going to get a manual gearbox as well, which would be... oh, we like a manual gearbox.
Yeah, we do
like a manual gearbox. So, of course, and as you pointed out before.
Yes, it's being developed at the same plant or built at the same plant as the Supra is being built, or Toyota's sports car.
The new Supra, we're all saying. So it should be, hopefully, I just wanted to be a bit more sporting than the old one was, because it seems wrong that BMW should produce, you know, pretty much, well, along with the i8, I suppose, it's sort of most sporting looking car. If you're going to look at it, I mean, it's two-seater roadster / coupe before.
Do you think it'll be sort of Boxster Cayman territory, or?
That's what we want, isn't it, really? I think that's what you kind of want from BMW. You know, they're meant to produce the ultimate driving machine. And if you're going to produce a two-seater rear-wheel drive sports car, then
it needs to be
good. It shouldn't just be a cruiser. Having said that, they've unveiled it in the United States, so perhaps it could be more of a boulevard cruiser. Let's hope it's a canyon crusher or whatever they call them. I don't know. But the manual gearbox is good, and the M differential bodes well. So and potentially as well, it's got a folding fabric roof rather than the folding hardtop. Then that leaves the way open for. I mean, we've seen the Supra is obviously going to be a coupe, so potentially we could get Z4 coupe and an M coupe. That would be good, wouldn't
cool.
it? Yeah. So that would, and then they go racing. Did you ever see the Z4 race cars?
I think I did.
They were really always just looked absolutely brilliant. You see them VLN races and stuff like that.
We'll
and
put
they
a picture up now and then.
Yeah, exactly. we'll find a picture because they look mega. Actually, talking of BMWs, I'm going to go into the race news. We'll come back to the other news in a second because MotoGP. Did you see it?
No.
I had it on for a few hours. Sort of. It was originally going to take place at like 11:30 in the morning at Silverstone, and then it just kept getting postponed through the day. And basically, there seemed to be a massive problem with the track.
Yeah, I did actually read,
and flooding.
Read about that.
The weather was pretty terrible.
It's the new surface.
Which is a particular problem, obviously, for the bikes because, well, they've only got two wheels. And it was pretty treacherous out there, and all the riders basically said, we're not riding this unless it improves. And poor old Susie Perry and Colin Edwards, etc., had to do basically like a 5-hour long stint on BT Sport, taking everyone through the day until they eventually said, no, we're not going to do it. But the most entertaining thing about it was actually watching the BMW M4 safety car drifting around the track. Intentionally or unintentionally, I'm not entirely sure. I'm not sure I had a great deal of choice given how spiky M4s we know can be in the wet. But that was pretty entertaining. There was other motorsport news over the weekend. So we had the F1.
I watched that.
You did watch that?
Yes, I did watch that.
Excellent. Did you watch the race or did you watch qualifying?
I watched the race. I didn't watch the qualifying.
Oh, wrong way round, no. I'm afraid.
Well, the first maybe 5 minutes of the race was definitely worth watching, but after that, it sort of everyone fell into their places, really.
It was terrifying, that accident, wasn't it? When we first saw it, it was just one of those, I think everybody held their breath, hoping that it was going to be all right. And I think there have been lots of critics of Halo. And after the trouble is, and it was always going to be the way that after an accident like that, you can no longer criticize it because it potentially.
They showed a shot of the damage actually on the.
Yeah.
I don't know if you saw that. It obviously impacted on the Halo. So
yeah, absolutely.
Can't really argue with that.
Yeah, and to be honest, Halo, I don't know about you, but it was one of those things after the first race, you just get used to it, don't you?
Yeah, you forget about it.
The human nature is to adapt to these things and accept, and I think, to be honest, most people did. So anyway, that was a spectacular crash, and you said it was like another one of Alonso.
2012.
Yeah,
they actually showed a replay of the 2012 crash after it happened. The similarities are crazy.
Spooky.
Yeah,
yeah.
So,
that source is always pretty crazy anyway, because it sort of seems madness coming hairy into the sort of pretty much what feels like the tightest hairpin out there. I know they've got lots of runoff on the exit, but it's utter madness. I would say qualifying was better to watch. Well, to be fair, Q3 was the best time to watch because the rain came down and Lewis put in one of those typical Lewis Hamilton laps that means whatever you think of Lewis's character, and he certainly makes mistakes and stuff off the track and robs people up the wrong way, so to speak, but he is he is somebody we really should be celebrating as a driving talent for the ages, one of the all-time greats, because laps like he pulled out of the bag round a wet Spa is something to behold. I mean, Kimi was also on fire. He loves Spa, and he's reminds everybody what a massive talent he is there. But Lewis,
what amazes me about Spa is just every time I see the shot of them going up Eau Rouge, just from the bottom, it's just how fast it is.
Yeah.
It's just unbelievable. It looks like it's in fast forward.
It's just incredible, isn't it?
Yeah.
And the I'm not sure if you so I don't know if they replayed it on the Sunday, but Sergio Perez had a massive moment during that Q3 going up. So he turns into Eau Rouge, but doesn't even make Radial at the top because halfway up the hill, he just gets on this huge drift. He's on the lock stop, so he's kind of sort of run out. But that was a save and a half through Eau Rouge to. Hold that and come out at the top. It was look it up. It's out there somewhere. So
it's also a moment where they were I can't remember who it was, but they were side by side going up Eau Rouge. It just made me feel so nervous. The speed that they're going up and how close they were. So crazy stuff.
It's a brilliant corner. I know it's been sort of in some ways neutered by modern F1 cars because they can take it flat out, obviously, and there's lots of. But in the wet, obviously, they can't, and it's a massive test of skill and bravery still, isn't it? It's absolutely brilliant. WRC was on the last round, was in Germany. Thank you, whoever said that. Germany. Why can I remember that? And Ott Tanak, since we last did a footlock and I spoke about it, Ott Tanak has been on fire. He's won the last two rounds, one gravel, one tarmac, and if he has another rally like that, he's 11 points behind Ogier at the moment, who's in turn is about 20 points behind Nerville. And it's looking like it could well turn out to be a three-way race for the title this year. It's fantastic seeing Ott Tanak coming back in and that Toyota hopefully getting a bit more reliability. It's because you went out and saw them.
I did, yeah.
Did you?
Oh, and I haven't followed much after that, Jesus, if I'm perfectly honestly. Honest.
It's Tanak coming back is he's just he seems to be pretty much on another level at the moment. I mean, Nerval is struggling because he's still leading, so therefore there's a certain amount of road sweeping going on at the moment. But we've got Turkey coming up, I think, this weekend, so we'll be looking out for that. And then we've got Wales Rally GB not long afterwards as well. We've got Spain in between as well. So it's busy old time for the WRC, and that is turning out to be an absolute cracker this season. So that's good. I'm really, really chuffed. It's nice to see not one manufacturer leading. It's, you know, pretty much any car apart from the Citroen, to be honest, could win it. So it's great. Back into, actually, no, just before we go back to, we'll stay on motorsport for just 1 second, because I watched last night the highlights from the Isle of Man TT Classic. Did you see that?
Missed that?
Oh, no. I can't believe you missed that. But just simply to say, it was so long to see. John McGuinness took the senior in that on a Pattern, which has been a very successful bike in that race. But it was he's come back from breaking what must have felt like basically every bone in his body. I mean, he broke legs and thumbs and back and all sorts of things, and it's been a long old road to recovery. And I think perhaps some people thought, probably not him, I'm sure, but lots of people thought he might never race around the Isle of Man again. But he was back there at the Classic TT and took a dominant victory on that bike, which was, I don't think anybody would begrudge him that. It was amazing to see. Tough breed, road races. Another breed, really. Anyway, back to the main car news. Aston Martin. Bit of Aston Martin news. Two things.
Yes.
Start off with the one that I don't really, I feel totally out of my depth with. Aston is going to float on the stock exchange. So from what I've read, up to about £1 billion worth of shares is going to be floated on stock exchange. So it depends, obviously, how the company's valued overall, but that could be up to about a quarter of the company.
£5 billion potentially is what I read on the BBC.
Okay, so
it could be valued at value the company at £5 billion.
So we'll go between £4 and £5 billion, which £1 billion pounds worth of shares will potentially be floated. And currently it's a mixture of Italian and Kuwaiti investors that own Aston Martin, plus a few other smaller investors. They had announced, fairly obviously, sort of they've been announcing, being keen to announce all their profit increases and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So their half-year financial results had just been announced, and they showed a 14% increase with profits up to £20.8 million, which sounds like a lot of money.
But they're exploring lots of areas at the moment.
They
bring all that cash in, aren't they? Like personal submarine. And have you heard they're doing the Aston Martin residences in Miami?
No.
This skyscraper in Miami.
Really?
Aston Martin residences.
Wow.
Yeah, and they're...
You're going to be able to park
buy,
a car.
You can buy a studio, I think, is about $500,000 up to about $38 million or something for the penthouse. Ridiculous.
Wow. So now you can live in your Aston Martin. That was used to the old thing, wasn't it? You can't drive your house, but you can live in your car.
The idea behind it is the door handles and stuff will be like Aston Martin design.
Wow.
Yeah. So there you go.
Perhaps they'll do some Bond themed ones, because that will bring us on to the next kind of sort of one, which Aston's obviously announced it's going to produce 25 DB5 Goldfinger cars. So in the same way they did the DB4 GT continuation, which you can see a video of me driving up on site. I loved that car. Go and watch that film. Not many people watch that film. I don't know why.
No.
Because it's a nice little shot,
cool,
and it's such a cool car. So go and find it. It's just, there's some lovely, lovely slow-mo shots of it drifting around Snatchton. So yeah, go and look that up. But they're producing 25 of these, as they did with DB4 GT continuation. And they're obviously going to be, well, recreations of the iconic silver birch coloured DB5, which has appeared in, well, first appeared in Goldfinger, since appeared, it was GoldenEye, I think it appeared in, because it was with a race with the 355 above Monaco just after he'd jumped off the dam. And then obviously in Skyfall, when Daniel Craig drove Judi Dench up to his ancestral home up there, and does get destroyed. Yes,
spoiler.
just in case you're one of the two people out there that hasn't seen Skyfall. But wonderful car. It's going to have some gadgets on it as well. They haven't really said what gadgets it's going to have, so we assume it's going to have a revolving number plate.
Yes,
that must be fairly easy to do. I remember the original one that had that amazing little sort of radar screen with the green beep. So that was that'll be in there.
Bulletproof
rear screen. That had up. And obviously you had the sort of the bits that would spray just oil out behind.
And the spikes, tire spikes, or something, I think.
It came out of the hubs as well. So you know, sort of knockoff wheel hubs that would sort of raise it. And obviously the machine guns out of the front bumper when they flip down and come out the front. And of course the ejector seat.
Oh yeah.
I mean, that's the big one. Who doesn't want the ejector seat in the car?
That's the coolest thing.
I can't see them really.
No.
I mean, it would be great even if they've got to do the gear stick with the button.
Yeah, I was
going to
say the button, and maybe it's a sunroof or something.
But so it'll be interesting to see what they put in there. It's kind of it's going to cost $3.3 million each one.
That's a lot.
Which is a lot. It's even more than the double the $1.5 million that they charge for the DB4 GT.
Sold them all already.
I'm pretty sure they will have done, because as somebody pointed out, these days people will jump on these things straight away because they want the next thing. They're afraid if they don't say yes to this, they won't get the Valkyrie AMR or whatever it is that they really want. So they're actually going to be 25 plus three more. So Aston's keeping one for itself. Fair enough. E.ON, who produce
the Bond films,
is getting one because they're helping out with the car. And presumably sort of allowing them to actually call it a sort of Bond recreation and stuff like that. And then one's going to be auctioned off for charity, at which point you sort of go, well, that's great, isn't
Fair
it? Because
enough,
if anything makes some money for charity, then that's obviously good. They won't, of course, be road registered. Now, and I can understand that for DB4 GT, because you drive it on track, it's a track car. So that's fine. It's no different to the Vulcan or something like that. But for this, understand why it can't be, but then,
and there's no way of someone who buys it, there's no way they can road register it
because it's a single vehicle, whatever it is. I don't know.
It's a shame.
Yeah, it is a shame, isn't it? I suspect somebody will find somewhere, and in some countries I'm sure it's much easier to do, so you'll be able
to
do it.
Sad to think that they might just sit in a garage.
Yeah. And this thing, I don't know what you do. You don't take Goldfinger DB5 to a track day, so where do you drive it at that point? What is the,
it's basically a show car, really.
I mean, I'm sure some people have estates big enough to drive them around and defend it. Sort of, well, it's Stoke Park, wasn't it, I think, that Stoke Park that Bond, Sean Connery played golf against Arrow Goldfinger.
I'm not sure.
I think I know what you're talking about,
but I'm not sure where it is.
With the Slazengers. Anyway, moving on from Aston Martin, other things unveiled at Pebble Beach: the 488 Pista, Ferrari 488 Pista Spider. That's a drop-top version of the 488 Pista.
I completely missed that.
Did you?
Yeah.
It was white and had a blue stripe down the middle. And they are saying that it's got the same powertrain. So just to remind you, it's 3.9-litre twin-turbocharged V8, 711 brake horsepower, 568 pounds-foot of torque, 0-62, 2.85 seconds, which is apparently exactly the same as the coupe, slightly slower to 124 miles an hour, so 8 seconds versus 7.6. And top speed is still 211 miles an hour. So, yeah. Now, Ferrari hasn't been brilliant in the past at actually making terribly structurally rigid Spiders, so I've sort of been a bit disappointed by some of them in the past, but hopefully they've solved it with 488. You never know.
Have you driven the Spider? 488 Spider?
That's a good question. I'm not sure that I have. I've obviously driven the coupe and love it to bits. It's fantastic. Still prefer 458 Speciale because it's got that naturally aspirated engine, and I kind of don't think you need any more. But
as well, actually.
But we do want to drive. I really want to drive 488 Pista. Regardless. So
need to make that film happen.
Yeah, when Ferrari let us do that.
Yeah.
Keep badgering them. Leave comments below saying something like that.
Maybe.
Yeah. You never know. It's hopefully anyway. Moving on. Other thing unveiled at Pebble Beach. Pebble Beach was quite good. I don't know. Do you like sort of cars sitting around on lawns? That sort of thing?
I would quite like to go. I think it's quite a cool Sounds like quite a cool.
It was a very event. Cool old Cadillac at the, I think, Quail, which was the concourse, and that sort of, or Pebble Beach, I don't know which one. But anyway, that looked, it just looked amazing. Sort of this huge, huge car with ridiculous coachwork on it. It's absolutely brilliant. So there is some very cool stuff there.
Yeah.
I saw somebody's a chap who I've met before, and he's let me drive one of his cars, who had a McLaren Senna in actually, I think, the best spec I've seen, which was
a dark green photo of that.
With, it was on lots of photos out there, sort of dark green with carbon stuff like that. And it did look really, really good, actually. It was the best one I'd seen. So well done for your spec on that, Philip. The other thing I unveiled, though, is the Bugatti Devo.
Yes, heard lots about that.
Yes. Sounds a bit like Diva, but it's named after Albert Devo, who was a racing driver who won Targa Florio twice for Bugatti. Based on the Chiron, and it's going to cost €5 million, which is basically double what a Chiron costs. And they're only building 40 of them. It's got the same engine in it, so it's still 1,500 horsepower. And it's got more downforce, so it's got 90 kilos more downforce, 456 kilos of downforce overall, which is good. It's not sort of out of this world by sort of current standards. I mean, the Senna we were just talking about, that's got 800 kilos of downforce, so yeah, that's a good chunk more. It weighs a whole 35 kilos less than a Chiron, which is really not very much.
No.
Although, again, they've stripped out the interior a bit. I've seen they have taken some weight out of the wheels. So if they've taken, I don't know, say they've taken if they've taken some unsprung weight out, is what I'm trying to say, basically.
Yeah.
If they've taken the unsprung weight out and that's where it's being saved from, then that can make a big difference to the way the car feels. As we discovered, in fact, we did a film on the GT2 RS last week. Week before?
I think it was 2 weeks ago.
It might be two. It's all blurring into one at the moment. But we've done that film, which will come out in the next few weeks, hopefully, when Charlie's edited it and I've done some voiceover. But yeah, you could definitely feel the difference there with the lighter magnesium wheels. So again, if they do the same with the Chiron Devo,
Chiron wheels made out of? Normal Chiron, do you know?
Unobtainium, obviously. So this is unobtainium light, probably. Or just less unobtainium. The rear wing is 23% wider, apparently, so that's going to look pretty amazing because it's already a big old thing. Tweak steering, so it'd be slightly sharper, increased camber. Apparently it will be homologated as a road car, so it's not going to be like the DB5 Goldfinger. It's going to be able to be out there on the road, which I didn't expect, actually. I saw it and thought it was going to be a track day special, and they're saying it's a full 8 seconds quicker round Nardo, which will mean absolutely nothing unless you know what the Nardo track is like, which I have heard it's amazing, but I've never driven there. It's quite a long track, so it's 6.2 kilometers, which is 3.8 miles, so it's about 2 seconds a mile quicker, which is not to be sniffed at, given that it's no more powerful. It is slower in the overall metric than the standard Chiron. It's 236 miles an hour top speed because you don't get the second key to unlock.
The speed key
To unlock the extra 24 miles an hour. That's because this is designed to be a Chiron for the corners.
So,
what do you think?
I prefer the looks of the Chiron over the Devo, personally, but I mean...
I agree.
Will we get a drive in that ever?
I don't know.
We'll be able to find out, because that would be quite cool.
It would, yeah. Talking of which leads us on to our Bugatti Chiron film, which went live this week.
No, Friday.
Friday. So, a week ago.
Yes,
a week ago.
In the last
By the time you see this,
it will be
a week ago, eight days. If you haven't seen it, go and watch it, please. To all those that have watched it so far, currently sitting on a sort of, I think, about a couple hundred thousand or just under. Thank you so much. Thank you for all the comments about it. It's one of those films, I'm always quite nervous before we put a film out as to how it's going to be received. But with this one, once I saw even the first rough draft that Charlie sent me, I was so chuffed because Charlie done a brilliant job, and it conveyed to me what I wanted to get across about the car. And we talked, I talked a lot about the handling of the car and what it's like on a twisty road as opposed to in a straight line. So exactly what they've tried to do with the Devo. But, I mean, go and watch the film, but it really does handle B Road incredibly well, certainly the one that we found, and was much, much better than I think even I thought it would be. Much more fun, actually. And it's, like I said in the film, it's a bit like a monstrous Fiat. And no, it's not as light and nimble as other cars, and something arguably like a Renault Alpine A110 or something like that, that's, you know, a fraction of the weight. Perhaps it would be more fun, but the point of the matter is that you've got this 1500 horsepower, and the question is whether you can use that in that setting and it still be enjoyable, or whether it's just a case of you pot around the corners, squirt it down the next straight, and then wait again. So whether it's this sort of enjoyment, frustration, or whether it's actually you can make it flow down the road and still use all that power. And yes, you're going to have to make some allowance of the weight. You can't get around that. It's a two-ton car. You're never going to be able to get around that. But if it can still be enjoyable and you can, you know, exercise that sort of power on that sort of road, then it becomes its own thing, and I think it does have a place. It becomes its own exercise, and it's certainly was. It was really, really enjoyable. We thought we'd have a look at some of the comments below and a couple of questions. One of the things, as I mentioned, that Jean Bugatti was sadly killed avoiding a cyclist. I should point out that it was a drunk cyclist, and therefore it was really a drunk on a bicycle rather than a cyclist. So yeah, the fact it was a drunk that just happened to be riding a bicycle. Yeah. It wasn't a sort of
the bikes.
No, exactly. It wasn't
in any way.
Somebody in
it was just an idiot, essentially. Because there's a lot of blame on the on cyclists in the comments.
Absolutely. Which cyclist, is kind of really kind of. I felt pretty bad about that, to be honest. I mean, there I am, sort of, you know, to be a cycling and motoring journalist, and I suddenly feel like I've opened up a whole rift between people. So there we are. Yes, blame the drunks, not the cyclists, please. So going to the comments, Dom Kane. So good to see Stephen Merchant doing well after working with Ricky Gervais. Thanks very much, Dom. That's
I saw that. I don't really see it though.
Yeah,
Stephen Merchant.
Oh, thank you very much. That's very kind. He's a funny man though.
He is a funny man.
He's a very funny man. Yeah. Yes. Very.
Maybe that's what he is.
Maybe it was comedy. Nothing to do with the fact we're both tall and quite skinny. Anyway, moving on. So Venom 5809. I've been lucky enough to have been in a couple of Veyrons, and I love the Chiron, but I have to honestly ask, how is it worth double plus the price of a Veyron? I just don't see it. It's a good question, and I kind of agree. It's hard to see where it's in terms of the sort of quality. Has it been a step change in quality? No, because the Veyron was extraordinary. If you ever sat in one of those and pressed the buttons, that was equally phenomenal sit in. And I love the thing. One of the things we tried to get across is the fact that the interior has a simplicity to it, because they know that this is going to have quite a long shelf life by the time they've built all 500 Chirons. And it was the same for the Veyron. I mean, that was out for ages and ages. So they tried to, they didn't put a sat nav screen in there that's going to look horribly outdated in 2 years' time. They wanted it to be something that was going to look timeless inside. And I think the reason the Chiron costs more is simply, you know, it's the market has moved on in that time.
I mean, when did the Veyron come out?
It was 2005.
I was going to say five.
Or five, I think, I wasn't it? So well over a decade ago.
So, yeah, right? I mean, there's also inflation in that. I mean, it's not double the price, but no. I agree, the market has moved on. And
I think it's a case of what people will pay for this sort of car. I mean, at the time, obviously, they struggled to sell Veyrons by the sounds of it, really, hence all the special editions and that sort of thing. But subsequently, we had the Holy Trinity, as they got called, LaFerrari 918 and P1, and they sort of triggered, initially, I think they struggled to sell some of those, not Ferrari, obviously, because they have the magic touch of being able to sell these things. But subsequently, once people realized, and it obviously helped with the car market booming and people speculating on these things, suddenly the price for all these things, just what people were prepared to pay, increased no end. And Bugatti has, I don't say cashed in on that, but it's just, I suppose, if you're going to make something as well that stands out, and you're going to say this is the best, this is the pinnacle, then you have to charge like it's the best. I mean, they might, I have no idea, perhaps they could sell it for $1.5 million.
Yeah.
But I suspect not, and I suspect because the Veyron famously, I think, lost money on everyone they sold, didn't they? So I suspect they didn't really want to do that again either. So a combination of perhaps the Veyron being underpriced and the market having moved on, that's probably why the price has moved on so much, rather than, as you say, any particular sort of leap in quality, because the Veyron, as you rightly pointed out, was already of enormous quality itself. Next question we've got from Pim and Max, both really asked the same thing. Amazing video, thank you very much indeed. Amazing videography. What camera set are you using? Which cameras are you used making this piece of art? GH5's Red C200. Well, I think I can take this one because Charlie, what did you use?
Well, firstly, there were two of us. It was George and myself shooting, and the main camera we use is Sony FS7, which, if people are into cameras, should probably know is what it is, because most, I would say, it's probably one of the most common cameras, sort of professional cameras. Low-level professional. It's nothing like cinema cameras like your Reds, which Pim mentioned there. We don't shoot on Red because it's just far too difficult to even begin to comprehend how to carry that kind of fully rigged Red around like we did on GT2 RS. Shot one film with it, but we won't be doing it all the time. But yeah, FS7, GH5. GH5 is an amazing little camera.
If anyone's
Panasonic, yeah. Panasonic GH5, if anyone's even considering to sort of start getting into video at all, that's like a great entry level. It'll do everything that you need it to do. So those two cameras, yeah, spot on really. We have one on a small little gimbal so we can move around quickly, because of course we only had 12 hours with the car, really.
Yeah, probably.
To shoot the whole film.
That, but yeah.
So we can never travel with all the gear we'd like, but being able to have two cameras with quite light setups means we can, run up and down the road quite a lot, get all the shots we need.
And of course, a drone as well.
And the drone.
Yeah.
Drone's important. Never want to overuse a drone, but putting 2-3 great drone shots in there can really add something to it, I'd say. It's also worth mentioning, you need to be very careful where you place cameras on cars like this, because they are very expensive. So with the Chiron, I would love to do loads of bolt-on shots on the outside, but because it was bare carbon, we were told we weren't allowed to put any cameras actually on those areas that
some of it
had
carbon.
Some had the paint protection film on it, which is why there's only a very few bolt-on angles. But what can you do?
What can you do?
You don't want to damage 2.5.
no, you don't really do. It's kind of actually sort of so. Somebody else asked that. I don't know, says that's his handle. I think he doesn't know how much that car costs, otherwise, he wouldn't have driven that fast. Well, I mentioned how fast it or how much it costs in the first sentence of the film, pretty much. So, I did know how much it costs, but it's a fair point. Because obviously some of these cars do cost a huge amount of money, and more than I'm probably likely ever to earn in my entire life. So how do you get over that? Does it intimidate you? Yes, to some extent. Certainly when I started doing this job, you can't get away from that fact, and this is sort of might nag at you a little bit, but you have to you have to get away from it, because otherwise I can't do my job properly, I think, really, in terms of you always respect any car, because it's at the end of the day, it's somebody else's property. It's my own Escalade, I can do what I like with it, but most of the time it's somebody else's property, and of course you're going to respect that and respect the car, respect the engineering that's gone into it, and be mechanically sympathetic no matter what it is. But with something like a Chiron, yes, you're very aware that it's going to be a very expensive accident, but equally you can't let that sort of rule the way you drive the car, because otherwise I couldn't push it and see what it's like and tell you what it's like. So yeah, you have to kind of remember that it is just a car at the end of the day, and it will understeer or oversteer, and you know, it's four-wheel drive or it's rear-wheel drive or it's front-wheel drive, and the engine's in a certain place. So once you know all these things, you can start to understand what it's like and what it's probably likely to do, I suppose, in certain situations, and that helps you to push it. And yeah,
it's also down to capability, really. I mean, if you put me in a Chiron, there's no chance I'd be driving like that, because I'd probably be going up 20 miles an hour everywhere, I'd be terrified. But if you've driven these cars like this before, like the Veyron and even other supercars, then I'm sure you have more confidence in
doing it and
not having an accident.
Yeah, and the other thing is to say that, you know, I generally, basically whatever I do, it's sort of, it's, you get into these cars and you start off, you build up to it. You don't just jump straight in and try and drive it as fast as you can down a piece of road, because that would be irresponsible. And you miss so much if you try and do that as well. You want to know what the car's like at low speeds and get used to the steering weight and how it transitions its mass around, and just understand the car from at every level, because it's more enjoying that way. You get sort of more idea of the depth, and as we started the film out, just sitting there in it quietly looking at all the detail in it, that's lovely as well, I think. So certainly with a car like that, so yeah, all sorts of things. But yes, I was aware of how much it cost. Next question. Now I don't know how to say this one. This is all run together, so it could be oven or way, or it could be Ove Norway, possibly. Anyway, question for Henry. You have driven both this and the McLaren F1, different cars from different times, I know, but if you had to choose, what would you pick?
Interesting question.
Yeah. What would you pick, Charlie?
McLaren F1.
Yeah. Yeah, it would have to be the McLaren F1.
I haven't driven either, but just British. It is the original hypercar for me.
Yeah, I think it's sort of, for me, I mean, I grew up revering the McLaren F1. I've been lucky enough to drive a couple, and there is nothing like that engine in particular. The sound of it, the seating position in it, it's and the attention to detail. You can compare the two to some extent. I think as much, there's different, they're going about things in different ways, but the engineering detail in both cars is enormously, enormously impressive. And I think anyone that approaches the Veyron or the Chiron as purely sort of blunt instruments with just a lot of power to go in a straight line, you know, it's Andy Wallace said, these are not cars that you build in your garage at home. They've thought about everything, because it has to be as reliable as a Golf, and do these big speeds whilst upholding the VW group and brand integrity, I suppose. So under the skin, they are exceptional pieces of engineering, just as the McLaren F1 was. But for absolute purity, I think it won't surprise anybody to know that I'd have the McLaren F1, particularly one of the LMs, I think. Not that I've ever driven one, but I just like the idea of the LM. Yeah. It was a particular favourite. So yes, thank you very much for your question. And I think that was pretty much all the other things. There was one big thing which a few people mentioned. Very nice video, says Roger. I don't buy that it wouldn't be able to deploy its power surge effectively if it was lighter. Argument at all, though. Sure, a heavier car pushes the tyres hard down into the tarmac, but the benefits of this generally overridden by the disadvantages of the effects of the inertia caused by the weight and anything you want the car to do, accelerate, brake, steer. And Albo Pastrami also said, great vid, but the more weight helps. Helps point from Bugatti is BS. Yes, it'll help in some aspects, but overall lower weight, it will always be preferential. And yes, that's, I suppose, that's what I meant. And what they mean is the fact that obviously a lot of what defines this car is the straight line figures, and that's where the weight does help. No, of course, on a twisting piece of road, lighter weight is going to be better, all the way down to something like the light car company Rocket, which is, you know, the stable motor for McLaren F1, I suppose, because it was Gordon Murray designed. Lightweight is better. I'm not saying that for a second, but I definitely, I heard this from Nissan as well in terms of the GTR, just in terms of actually getting that traction, which is what Chiron is known for, and that sheer accelerative force, and being able to do that sort of repeatedly and so impressively in terms of, you know, once the tires are up to temperature, not that much temperature in either, it can take full throttle in first gear, which is bonkers.
500
yeah
horsepower.
It is just, I mean, to do that you need a certain amount of weight pushing the tires into the tarmac, and so that's what I was getting at. No, of course, yes, the braking and the steering and all that sort of thing aren't going to be helped by extra weight, but purely in terms of going fast in a straight line, that's where the, if it weighed 300 kilos less, then it would be slower. Fact comes from, and came from, Andy Wallace, who is, to be honest, a man who set more straight line speed records, I think, than most people probably watching this and knows what he's talking about. So yeah. I'm happy to trust Andy Wallace on this. So he's wouldn't trust him on everything, obviously. Jeepers, I mean, but on that, I'll give him that. So yes, thank you once again for all the kind comments on that. We'll keep striving to push the car filming forwards and all that. So we're so pleased that everyone liked it, and please do share it around, because it helps us enormously. It's sort of, I know it's one of those things where we go, please like and share, but sharing this around, on whether you see it on Facebook or on YouTube, or anywhere else for that matter, and just telling other people about it and the stuff we do does help enormously. So please do that. A couple of other films sort of coming back down to earth a little bit. We've had the Land Rover Defender, What It's Like to Live With 6 Months, which is really a roundup of stuff we've done in Footlock, really, isn't it?
There is actually some behind the scenes stuff in there from Bugatti.
There is. So yeah, because we drove it out to Molsheim. So yeah, have a look at that. It's just a quick Carfection Plus film, but yeah, rounds up a few of our thoughts on living with the Defender, which has overall been very, very positive.
It has, yeah.
It has. Yeah, it's been away for about a month or so, but we'll talk about that next time when Drew is about, we'll keep people on tenterhooks. Yeah. What could that be about?
What happened to it?
Yeah, absolutely. The other film, Luftgekühlt, I want to talk about, which was down at Bicester Heritage, which I think I failed to mention in the film actually where it was.
Yeah, I think someone was
asking.
Pick
up on that. So yeah, sorry about that. I should have mentioned it was at Bicester Heritage, which is an old Air Force base. It was actually built in 1936, which is why so much of it has sort of remained extant and in good order, because before the Second World War, things were generally built to a higher quality, whereas once war broke out, things were just thrown up any old how because they needed the buildings. Anyway, it still exists. It's a wonderful place. Have you been down there?
I never have.
Actually. Oh, you should go. It's it's a great place to wander around, and a perfect setting for this Luftgekühlt exhibition, which is a show of old air-cooled Porsches, Luftgekühlt meaning air-cooled. And it's been across in on the west coast of America for 5 times, I think. And then this is, perhaps this is the fifth one. It was the first one in the UK, anyway. And Jess Vaught, who sort of positions all the Halo cars in this just beautifully in terms of sort of frame them up, and we tried to capture some of that in the film, so, and we interviewed him about it in the rain. So
Yeah, I didn't film that, but Ollie did a great job.
He did a really good job. Yeah, particularly really given the
conditions.
The conditions, which was really
cool.
So go and have a look at that if you like old Porsches, because it's a feast for the eyes.
Yeah,
I think so. And that, I think, brings us to the end of this footlock. You survived. Well done, Charlie. Anything else you wanted to add? I don't think so.
Not really.
Really? Got stuff coming up next week and that sort of thing. So please, once again, subscribe, like, check us out on Instagram. We're doing quite a few more Instagram stories. Drew's been doing quite a lot of Ask Me Anything things. He's been very good at that.
Yes, he
has. Not that I can, because I haven't got logins, but but he's been very good doing behind the scenes on A8 and Q8. You did the other night.
A8. A8 at night, Q8. The day before, I think it was.
Yeah. So go and check out the Instagram stories, because you get more behind the scenes stuff there as well. And thank you very much for watching and or listening. We really do appreciate it, and keep the comments coming.